Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Over My Dead Pod. I'm Kylie Colwell.
This is Kate Carter.
And I'm Holly Spear.
Today's episode, not to brag, but this is the most research I've ever done for a case.
Oh.
Because this one has haunted me since I started listening to True Crime podcast. I don't know how many years ago. We have a lot to go over, so I'm going to start by taking us to the night of February 9th, 2004. A little after 7 p.m., Faith Westman heard a loud thump outside her house. She peeked out the window to see a small black sedan crashed into a snowbank. The town of Woodsville, New Hampshire, like most of the Northeast, was being hit with heavy snow, and this bend in front of her house was already known for being an area where people crashed often. So Faith called the police to report the single vehicle accident, but when police and EMS arrived, there was no one in the car and no footprints in the snow leading from it. And this is the story of the disappearance of Maura Murray.
This is a good one. This
I
also
know.
Has been in the back of my brain forever.
Yeah, I'm glad you guys know it so we can theorize.
Yeah, but I'm also glad you did a bunch of research because I mean, I know it, but I'm ready to hear what you have to say too.
So Maura Murray was an all-around overachiever as described by her family and friends. She grew up in Hanson, Massachusetts, which is a little south of Boston, with her typical Irish Catholic family. So we have her older dad, Fred, mom, Lori. She has an older brother also named Fred, older sister, Kathleen, older sister, Julie. And then after her parents divorced when she was six, she got a younger half brother, Curtis. So Maura, like her siblings, was very smart and basically had her pick on where she wanted to go to college. She graduated fourth in her class, and she also set like multiple state records in cross country and track. So she had like Harvard and Yale, you know, knocking at the door. But Maura ended up choosing to go to West Point, where her older sister, Julie, was at. Hard school to get into. She got
really hard. Yeah.
Senator nomination from Edward Kennedy. A Kennedy.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah, that is really cool. And definitely, I will say too, West Point in 2004, first of all, had less females than you would even imagine, for sure. But even to this day, that's one of the harder academies to get into.
So she was a smart girl.
Yeah.
So in the fall of 2000, Maura began her freshman year majoring in chemical engineering, also while running on the track team. Now, if you don't know much about military academies, obviously, they're very strict, grueling, especially the first year. So Maura wasn't struggling with the demands of the school. She was doing pretty good. She just kind of realized like military life wasn't for her. And then also, as we know, during her second year, 9/11 happened. And so the possibility of being deployed became a real fear. And her sister Julie's podcast called Media Pressure, she interviewed some classmates, and this was like a common fear. Everyone was like, you know, we wanted to go to a great school, great academics, free college. Wasn't really planning on getting deployed. So after weighing out her options, Maura transferred to the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. So it's about 2 hours west of her hometown, so close enough to visit family, but still far enough away to live an independent life. Back at West Point, Maura had started dating this guy named Bill, and their relationship was a little rocky, off and on, but after Maura transferred, they decided to continue and just have a long-distance relationship. They did visit during breaks and stuff like that. So now she's at Amherst, and she's thriving again. She's a star on the track team. She's majoring in nursing, and she's working at an on-campus security job and also at an art gallery. Then 2003 rolls around and Maura got injured, forcing her out of the track season. In November, she got caught and admitted to using a stolen credit card to order food late at night. And this wasn't the first time Maura got into some trouble. When she was at West Point, she got caught stealing a couple dollars worth of makeup from a store. And I couldn't find out if she got in trouble for this or if she had transferred before anything happened. But this time, Maura was facing criminal charges. Luckily, as long as she had 3 months of good behavior, so no more crimes, the charges would be dismissed. A lot of internet theories, rumors kind of point to these like little crimes as like a way to show that Maura was like heading down the wrong path or things were going downhill. I mean, I think they're just kind of like stupid little mistakes. And then in her sister's podcast, Julie said that Maura was also struggling with bulimia, and she believes that the late night credit card food purchases were more binging and purging. So just painting a bigger picture.
I don't get any like serious red flags, to be honest. You know, like I think it's just young, dumb shit mixed with maybe some issues going on.
Typical 20-year-old girl.
I was going to say, weren't we all like that? Yeah. I was.
Yep. So Christmas and New Year's came and went, seemingly uneventful. Unfortunately, for a lot of Maura's family, they didn't realize the holidays would be the last time they would see her. The new semester started late in January, and some family had gone to help Maura move into her new single dorm. The events of this case really began on February 5th, 2004, a Thursday. That night, while working at her on-campus security job, checking students' IDs, Maura's sister Kathleen called her. Around 10:30 p.m., after the call had ended, Maura's supervisor found her crying and basically zoned out. A little after midnight, Maura called her boyfriend, Bill. The call lasted about 7 minutes. He said it was a normal conversation. Nothing really stuck out to him. But Maura still seemed a little distraught to her supervisor, so she walked Maura back to her dorm, and she asked her what was going on, and all Maura said was, "My sister." For years, there was a lot of speculation about this phone call from her sister, Kathleen. People were theorizing that this was a lie, which will make sense in a bit. But Kathleen did come out to say in 2017 that she was explaining to Maura what happened that day. So Kathleen had gotten discharged from her rehabilitation program for alcoholism. And when her fiance picked her up, he stopped at a liquor store, causing a relapse. So obviously, a lot of emotions for everyone with that. Yeah. So the next day, classes were canceled due to a snowstorm. But on Saturday the 7th, Maura's dad, Fred, arrived in town to go car shopping. Maura had been driving a 1996 Saturn sedan that was on its last leg. They spent the day going to different used car dealerships, but ultimately didn't buy anything. Fred and Maura ended the night by going out to dinner and stopping at the liquor store, where Maura bought a box of Franzia wine. Do you guys remember those boxed wine, Franzia, at the frat parties?
Oh, girl, do I. Slap the bag.
So after the liquor store, Maura dropped her dad off at his hotel and then took his car back to campus like a mile away to go to a little dorm party around 10:30 p.m. So in all the reports, everyone who's at this party either doesn't remember anything from it because they were drinking, claimed to be asleep. Like, no one really knows what happened at this party.
Yeah.
But the consensus seems to be that around 2:30 a.m., Maura leaves. She goes to her dorm room, which was just downstairs, but then for some reason she leaves in her dad's car. At 3:30 a.m., Maura struck a guardrail on Route 9, severely damaging the car. An officer did respond and write up an accident report, but he did not administer any field sobriety tests, and Maura did not receive any medical treatment. I don't know if the car or how bad the car was, but they said it was like $10,000 in damages. It had to be towed. I don't know if the airbags were deployed, but like, I feel like if it's that serious, EMS has to show up.
Right? Yeah. And if they don't do any field sobriety tests, I feel like hitting a guardrail, I don't know.
At 3:30 in the morning?
Yeah.
But I also feel like you can deny EMS, even if they're there.
That's true.
Yeah.
So the car ended up being towed back to the hotel and Maura stayed the night there. Apparently she had left her cell phone in her dorm, so she called her boyfriend at 4:49 a.m. using her dad's phone, distraught about the situation. He explained that everything will be okay, just get some sleep and they'll deal with it in the morning. The next morning, Maura's dad, friend, learned that the insurance was going to cover the damage, so no biggie. He literally said it in Julie's podcast, like, never once raised his voice, like, wasn't pissed off at all. No one's mad at Maura. Something to note. He had to leave for work the next morning, so he rented another car, dropped Maura off, and reminded her to get the accident report so he could send them into his insurance. They agreed to talk about it on Monday night. So now we're caught up to the day of the car accident, or the second car accident, February 9th. A little after midnight, Maura searched for directions to the Berkshires and to Burlington, Vermont on her computer. At 3:32 a.m., she submitted her nursing homework online. Maura was known to be a night owl, so it wasn't out of the ordinary for her to be up at this time. Because, you know, I love to go on Reddit and see what the people think. There's this, I don't know, misconception, people not reading everything. People theorize that Maura was pregnant because she was searching, like, pregnancy terms at this time. But we know her homework assignment was, her nursing homework assignment was pregnancy right. stuff.
Yeah. I feel like you also, they would have been able to find stuff in her residence that would point to her being pregnant if she was pregnant.
To test something, doctors.
Yeah. Yeah.
So after this, she seemingly falls asleep for a bit. And then the next recorded contact was at 1 p.m. and she emailed her boyfriend, Bill. Laura wrote, quote, "I love you more, stud. I got your messages, but honestly, I didn't feel like talking too much of anyone. I promised to call today, though. Love you, Maura," end quote. After this, she called a woman about renting a condo in Bartlett, New Hampshire, a condo that her family has stayed at a few times. The call lasted 3 minutes, but Maura didn't end up booking it. At 1:13, she called fellow nursing student Aaron about dropping off some clothes that Maura had borrowed. Aaron said it was no biggie, don't rush, I'll get them next time I see you. Then, oddly, at 1:24 p.m., Maura emailed her work supervisor and said she would be out of town for the week due to a death in the family, explaining that she would contact her again when she returned to campus. You might have guessed it, there was no death in the family.
I remember this part. This was weird.
I mean, that's a very common college mm-hmm. student excuse for getting out of class or anything.
My grandma died.
Yeah.
You know, something like that.
For the fourth time.
Yeah. My fourth grandma.
For the next bit of time, Maura and her boyfriend Bill played a bit of phone tag, continually missing each other's calls and leaving voicemails. Around 3, Maura left his clothes at Aaron Murphy's door, neatly folded. Aaron was taking a nap at the time, and she didn't hear a knock. By 3:15 p.m., Maura had left campus in the black Saturn sedan. Her first stop was to an ATM where she withdrew $280. The security footage from the ATM showed Maura was alone, wearing a white jacket, jeans, black shoes, and her hair up in a bun like it was most of the time. Her next stop was a liquor store where she bought $40 worth of booze, Bailey's, Kahlua, and vodka. She also recycled 79 cans, and she got $3.95 back for them. After this, she presumably headed north on Interstate 91. At 4:37 p.m., she called to check her own voicemail. And this is the last time her cell phone has been used. A little after 7 p.m. was when Faith Westman heard the thump, and she called the Grafton County Sheriff's Department at 7:27 p.m., explaining the single vehicle accident on the Horseshoe Bend right across from their barn. The 911 call log said that Faith said she saw a man smoking a cigarette inside the car. Faith said she never said this. She said she just saw like a red glowing light. She assumed it was from like a cell phone, and she couldn't tell if it was like a man or woman from that far away. So I don't know if it's just like a typo or error, whatever. Before police arrived, another neighbor, Butch Atwood, passed by the accident in his bus. He saw a young woman walking around the car. She wasn't bleeding or visibly injured in any way, just cold and shivering. Butch offered to call 911 for her, and according to him, this woman basically pleaded for him not to. She said she already called AAA. Butch offered for her to wait for them at his house, which was about 100 yards away, to get out of the cold, but she declined. Now, Butch knew she was lying. There was no cell service in this area. And according to reports, there's still not any cell service over there. So he's like, okay, I know she didn't call AAA. So he headed back to his house, and he called 911 from there, and he reported the accident at 7:42 p.m. A Haverhill police officer arrived at 7:46 p.m. to find no one there. The car had hit a tree on the driver's side, pushing the radiator into the fan, rendering it undrivable. The windshield was cracked and both airbags deployed. The car was also locked. A rag was also stuffed into the muffler, which we later learned that Maura's dad told her to do this anytime there's like smoke coming out of it in case of an accident, so she didn't get a ticket for the exhaust, whatever. Around the car, there were no footprints in the snow, like leading off into the woods. There were red stains, but this was quickly deduced to be red wine, as a damaged box of Franzia wine could clearly be seen behind the driver's seat. EMS and a fire truck arrived at the scene a few minutes after the officer, but EMS was dismissed pretty quickly since there was no one there to be treated, which I don't agree with, because at this point, no one searched for her. Like, no one's left where the car is. If she's injured and like walked off, even like a couple, 100 yards away, and they do find her, EMS won't be there. Once EMS was dismissed, the firefighters, the officer, and even the neighbor did search for a little bit. They couldn't find anything, but they only searched to the west of the crash site, and no one knows why they didn't search to the east. At 8:49 p.m., Maura's car was towed to a local private garage, and the officer and Butch drove around a bit before giving up at 9:30 p.m. The assumption was that Mara was intoxicated with the alcohol in the car and her not wanting Butch to call 911. So she must have either ran off or had someone pick her up to avoid being arrested. Butch later reported that Mara did not seem impaired whatsoever. Obviously, like, police never saw or spoke to her. They just saw the alcohol in the car. Doesn't necessarily mean she drank any of it.
Or then, you know, like, what if that was, like, not from that time period?
Exactly. On the morning of the 10th, a local judge signed off on a search warrant for Mora's car in order to identify the driver. Inside the car, like I said, was the box of wine, and there was also an empty beer bottle. Some reports said that there was a Coke bottle that smelled like alcohol as well. Inside, there was also Mora's AAA card, gloves, CDs, makeup, jewelry, college textbooks, clothes, a stuffed animal, the accident report forms, directions to Burlington, Vermont, a book about mountain climbing called Not Without Peril, and a handwritten note with a name and a phone number. To break this down a bit, we don't know when, but sometime on Monday, Mora did pick up the accident report forms from the DMV for her dad before she left. So to me, this is a sign like she wasn't planning on peacing out for very long.
That's a huge controversy in the story. I mean, that's a, you know, what people kind of fight against. Because I remember thinking like, oh, she ran. Like there's something that made her go. And then you realize the back story where you would have taken more things if you were leaving for a longer time.
Oh, that's what people say, is that she just ran away.
That's a theory. That's but a then theory. It's like, wow. If you're running away, like college textbooks, accident right. report forms.
Yeah.
Yeah. She submitted her homework right before she left. Like that's never been in my mind, you know, from you telling this story in this amount of time. I've never thought, oh, she's running away.
Some people still think that. So the book, Not Without Peril, it comes up a bit. It's an eerie name, but it's just a book about mountain climbing. It's also a name of like one of the earliest message boards about the case. So that'll come up. And then the handwritten note, Julie said, who's Mora's sister, that the name and the phone number was the lady with the condo that Mora called about renting about. And according to Julie, police never once contacted this lady and asked like why her name and phone number were in Mora's car.
Love that. Love it.
So what was missing from the car was Mora's debit and credit cards, her cell phone, and the liquor bottle she purchased that day. So all the liquor except for the boxed wine is gone. This is what throws me off. If she walked off from the crash site, like, are you going to carry 3 bottles of liquor, like, in your hands or in your backpack? Even if she was drinking, she didn't drink 3 whole bottles of liquor.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
So while police were going through the contents of the car, a BOLO or be on the lookout was issued to New Hampshire police for a woman wearing a dark coat, jeans, and a black backpack. A second BOLO was issued an hour later to also include Vermont and Massachusetts, adding that Mora was 5'5", 120 pounds, and had black hair. Mora was actually 5'7". She had lighter brown hair, which is something police could have easily searched up in their database. And we also know from the ATM footage that Mora was wearing a white coat, not dark. But she could have changed clothes, I guess. At 3:20 p.m., the police left a voicemail on her dad Fred's house phone saying Mora's car was found abandoned. Fred was actually out of town for work and didn't learn about his daughter until around 5 p.m. when one of the older sisters called him. So the family is pretty confused and pissed off because they weren't notified until almost 24 hours after Mora disappeared.
Yeah.
I know the police didn't know her name when they responded to the crash, but they have the license plate. They have the VIN number. The car is registered to Fred, the dad. Her campus parking pass sticker is on the car. Could have called the campus up. I said, who is this assigned to? All of her card details, like AAA car with her name, all the stuff with her name on it, it's in the car.
Yeah.
Once Fred was able to get a hold of the Haverhill Police Department, he was told that if Mora was not reported safe and sound by the next morning, a search would begin. Shortly after this call, the police department officially listed Mora Murray as a missing person. So the Murray family, not wasting any time, headed to New Hampshire to find Mora, with Fred arriving the first before the sun even rose. At 8 a.m., the New Hampshire Fish and Game began searching, starting at the crash site. Fun fact, the Haverhill Police Department only has 4 officers.
Okay. I get small town, but I don't get to that extent.
I looked up on their website. They still only have 4 officers.
That makes no sense.
That's why Fish and Game hadn't come out. So.
Yeah. I don't know.
So tracking dogs were brought out to track Mora's scent using one of the gloves found in her car. The scent was tracked about 100 yards east, where it suddenly stopped. This point was right at the intersection of Route 112 and Bradley Hill Road. So police immediately came to the conclusion that Mora, like, got into another car at that point. The family disputes the validity of this scent tracking, though. They say the gloves were a gift from her boyfriend, Bill, that she had just gotten a couple weeks ago, and they weren't even sure if Mora had worn them yet. Also, the scent tracking was done 36 hours after Mora was last seen there and in the snow, so not the most reliable. Right. Speaking of the boyfriend, Bill, he arrived with his parents around 5 p.m. after being granted leave. He was stationed in Oklahoma at the time. Bill was interrogated privately and then was joined in by his parents. We don't know the contents of these interrogations, but we do know Bill reported something odd. So while he's flying to New Hampshire, obviously phone's off in the air, when he lands, he turns his phone back on and he's got a voicemail from an unknown number. He listens to it and it's a woman sobbing and he swears it's Mora.
If I ever get a voicemail and it's someone crying from a number I don't know, I'll be flipping my shit.
Yeah, exorcism on my phone immediately.
Yep. I would be doing so much research. I mean, obviously I would tell the cops, but I'd also be doing my own detective stuff.
Please tell me they're able to trace the call.
This call was later traced to a calling card issued by the American Red Cross, which is just like a prepaid minute card that they hand out to people. And once it's handed out, there's no way to track who the card was given to.
How do you even get one?
So they hand them out to homeless people, or like cases of like natural disasters. They'll hand them out to people or like first responders to be able to contact loved ones.
Yeah, that's true. Because you're not going to be registering stuff, you know, if it's like for an emergency kind of situation.
So at some point, police did go through Mora's dorm room back on campus. I couldn't find out exactly when, though. So police noted that most of Mora's belongings were packed in boxes. Art was removed from the wall. And on top of one of the boxes was a printed email to Bill, which they said showed trouble in the relationship. The theory turned from Mora evading arrest for drunk driving to she ran away on her own accord or she committed suicide. The family disputes this. They said Mora had just moved into the new dorm, and when they had just visited her, she wasn't even close to being done unpacking. So she didn't repack everything up. It just was never unpacked. Julie also said that the email wasn't to Bill. It was from Bill, and it was one of these emails that Mora had printed because it was Bill's apology for cheating on her.
Oh.
And just a note, Julie said that there's like zero reason to believe that Bill was ever abusive or any kind of threat, or he's a suspect in any way. But Bill and Mora's dad held a press conference together in nearby Bethlehem, New Hampshire on the night of the 12th. And by the morning of the 13th, the first press coverage of Mora began to be published. So at this point, when Bill got the voicemail, the public did not know she was missing. It was only the family and the police. So I don't think it was like a prank phone call.
No. And what are the odds that that phone number like accidentally called the wrong person or something, you know?
Yeah.
The next week, Bill and Fred also appeared on CNN's American Morning to gain more coverage. And during the show, Fred said the family were also searching in Vermont, but the police never notified Vermont authorities about Mora. At some point while searches were going on, a possible sighting was reported 100 miles south in Concord. A witness came forward to say a young woman matching Mora's description mouthed the words, "Help me," to them. They reported this woman was with an older man, probably in his 60s, but they took off before the witness could get more information or record the license plate. And so nothing came from this tip. Nothing.
I mean, I'm not even going to ask how, but it's just, shit's frustrating.
10 days after Mora's disappearance, the FBI joined in, and the Haverhill police chief announced that the search was now nationwide. A second search was conducted on both the ground and also in the air with helicopters equipped with thermal imaging cameras. Tracking and cadaver dogs were brought out again, but also nothing. By the 27th, with nothing substantive coming up, police returned the items in Mora's car to the family, but kept the car. By March 2nd, the family was forced to check out of their hotels and return home. The family members, and especially Fred, did go back all the time to search with or without the police. Months went by with more of nothing until on July 1st, 2004, when police asked the family to return the items from Mora's car for forensic analysis. There were 109 items. To the family, they're like, okay, step in the right direction. They're still on this case. but they have not heard a peep about these items or what testing was done since then in 2004. On the 13th, around 100 people searched the area again, marking the first ground search done without snow, and again, nothing was found. Later in the year, a new tip renewed some hope that an answer was plausible. A man named Larry Moulton contacted Fred Murray and gave him a rusty, stained knife. Larry explained that the knife belonged to his brother Claude, who lived less than a mile from the scene of the accident, and who had been acting a bit weird since Maura disappeared. A few days after Maura's crash, Claude had his car scrapped and also moved out of his house. Later, Claude's ex-wife claimed that before moving, Claude had torn up the carpet in the basement, all of a sudden claiming there was water damage.
Heard that one before.
Fred had given the knife to police, but we don't know if any testing was done. Larry's family said not to trust him, though. He had a history of drug use and was just making this up for the reward money. But the Murray family kept all this in the back of their head, just in case. While the family is pretty much leading the charge, Fred had to put in Freedom of Information Act requests in order to see the case file. These requests were continually denied as Morris' disappearance was an ongoing and open investigation. The family did learn through these requests that police did administer 4 polygraphs, 1 wiretap, and we do not know who those were conducted upon, though, because the names were redacted. Another new tip came in November of 2005 when an unknown person posted on the Not Without Peril message board claiming to have seen a black backpack similar to Maura's and a restroom about 30 miles east of the crash site. The assistant attorney general in charge of the case said law enforcement was aware of the backpack, but did not disclose if it had been obtained. In October 2006, another volunteer-led search began and lasted for 2 days. Cadaver dogs were brought in and they went, quote, bonkers in the stairwell closet of a house about a mile away from the crash site. This was the former house of Claude Moulton, the man with the alleged knife.
Cadaver dogs, plural, by the way, plural. That would be very hard to say that that's a mistake of some sort.
I trust the dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Discolored carpet from upstairs was given to the police for testing, or so people thought. The carpet was given to the police. Apparently there was some sort of miscommunication and it took 2 years for the carpet to be brought to the police.
This, yeah, miscommunication.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And as usual, the results are not known to the public. The family that owned and lived in the house now at the time of these searches were very open to people coming in and searching. They said the house was haunted and their kids are scared. The family even bought and used luminol themselves on one of those closets under the stairwells, and they said it lit up like a Christmas tree.
Immediately. Also calling the FBI, not allowing local police to touch any of that.
No. So samples from the wood paneling were given to the family, who sent it off for testing with a private company, not the police. The blood returned as positive for both female and male blood, but the samples were too old and degraded to be able to match the DNA to anyone in particular. Also, at this house in the yard was this weird concrete slab. It was like in a random area. There was nothing built on it. So they had sonar imaging done on it. They couldn't really see anything, but the concrete had rebar, which, if you don't know, is like those metal bars to help support it, which is just weird. This weird concrete slab there.
And like, yeah. there was no purpose for it.
No.
They said it was like not, there wasn't like a well that was covered up, stuff like that. I don't quote me though, because obviously we hear thousands of stories, but I feel like in this case too, when they were doing the graphing on the well, there was someone who, like, this was his job, that he was like, this is a little weird, like a part of it, but they were like, not enough to go and get rid of the concrete to see what was going on.
Yeah, they're like, it's odd, but I mean, the imaging's not showing a body.
Mm-hmm.
Julie and Fred actually went to go speak to Claude years later. Claude, of course, denied knowing Maura was even missing at the time, claiming he was out of town. Earlier in the investigation, Claude's girlfriend confirmed he was, in fact, in town and at home at the time. When confronted about the blood found in his former home, Claude claimed to have zero clue about why it was there or who it belonged to. He also declined to take a polygraph. In 2020, Claude's daughter reached out to a regular poster on that Not Without Peril message board with photos of a journal entry that she claims came from Claude's journal. The entry was dated February 10th, 2004, the day after Maura was last seen. It's a little hard to decipher, but in part it reads, quote, "It's so those 100 years are a sense of real moments, one after another, again and again. What has me thinking about this now is my moment last night, that moment when I saw an angel and made her an angel. The moment plays over and over again and again, and I smoke cigarette after cigarette. The moment is gone. I know, but I am still high from that moment until the next moment," end quote.
Yikes.
All right, he did it.
Yeah.
That's enough evidence for me. Enough sketchy shit.
Weird poem about an angel the day after the girl goes missing?
Yeah.
Claude Moulton passed away in 2024. And as far as I'm aware, the Murray family has not commented on this reported journal entry.
To play devil's advocate, you don't know if it's real.
Yeah. So the internet tends to lean towards Claude. Obviously, it's a little weird, a little sketch. But is he like just the guy that like he's the only name we have? Is that, are we just like latching onto that? I don't know. What do you guys think about Claude?
The blood situation in the house is not a good look.
Yeah.
I've always felt that it was him, but you're right. It's the only name we have. We also have no idea who those four polygraphs were that the police did or the wiretapping. Yeah. I was really hoping that it would come out someday that the wiretapping was him. The flip side of this where a lot of people also just thought she ran away. And they were like, she did a really good job of making sure nobody knew she was running away to like start a different life.
I do not think that at all.
Mm-mm.
Well,
the only thing I think is that the police did such a bad job of everything that I don't trust that they didn't search the scene well enough to know, did she get scared that she had just wrecked a car and she was driving under the influence and she just like ran away from the scene and then maybe got lost and kind of didn't you say it was snowing too?
Yeah, that is a theory that she ran off to hide from the police and succumb to the elements.
Yeah, like we know that she didn't want the neighbor to call the police. I think it's more likely that someone took her from the scene, like just saw an opportunity, like the guy. But I think also I don't trust that the police searched the scene well enough to say that she didn't just kind of run and hide.
That's kind of where I'm leaning. Like, if we can't pin a specific person, like, that would be my next best answer.
Yeah. They're like, oh, there's no tracks, but you also, like, have her description wrong and the missing information. You also, like, don't contact her parents. They just saw these mistakes that it makes me skeptical that they just haven't done a good job with investigating the scene.
Let me second that. Of course, one of the leading theories is that she ran off on her own accord. And like Kate said, like all the planning, like to run away, like stage the perfect accident. If it was like perfectly staged, why would she be like searching on her computer, like the directions, you know what I mean? And like calling the lady about the condo.
Yeah.
He did it. He killed her. That's my first option.
Mm-hmm.
Or she succumbed to circumstances after fleeing the scene.
Another point is that Maura might have had like a traumatic brain injury from either of the two car crashes that she was in.
Yeah.
So that's why nothing makes sense. I do have one more theory, something I did not bring up, and that is the police officer theory.
Do tell.
So as we know, Faith Westman called the sheriff's department at 7:27 p.m. after hearing and seeing the crash. Butch Atwood pulled up on the scene and drove home, calling in at 7:42 p.m., according to police records, the responding officer, Cecil Smith, arrived at 7:46 p.m. But, we have a witness who reports seeing a different police SUV parked at the scene 10 minutes before Cecil Smith arrived.
A marked police car?
Mm-hmm. So Karen McNamara was driving down Route 112 that night when a police SUV marked with 001 passed her. She pulled off to the side since the SUV had its lights on and kept driving. Later down the road, the SUV passed her again. And again, there's only four police officers in this town. So
001 is the supervisor.
He is the chief of police.
Look at me knowing shit.
At 7:36 p.m., Karen passed the crash site and saw the black Saturn and the police SUV parked nose to nose. Butch was presumably on the way back to his house where he was going to make the 911 call, and he has stated before that he didn't see any other cars behind him, but he also couldn't see the crash site from his house.
Right.
So we know Karen passed the crash site at 7:36 p.m. because she called a family member at 7:52 p.m. later down the road when cell service finally picks up. And Maura's sister, Julie, has, like, driven this route several times and, like, backs up this timeline. Like, okay, if she called at this point when service picks up, she was at the crash site at 7:36. Chief of Police, Jeff Williams, it's his car, SUV-001. According to police records, he was not on duty that night.
So he just happened. He just happened to drive by.
I don't know. He had his lights on. I don't know if he...
But he also didn't report it.
Yeah. So I don't know. Like, if he's not on duty, why was he in his police car?
Right.
Listening to the dispatch.
Yeah.
And then doesn't tell any of the other officers that he will be responding to it?
Yeah.
Weird.
That's zero. And being the chief of police, like, that makes zero sense.
Exactly. Like, you're in a town with four police officers.
Yeah. And it's going to be his word against hers, I assume.
Yes. So conveniently, years later, Jeff Williams led one of his own officers on a high-speed chase when he drunkenly crashed a motorcycle.
I love that. Okay. Oh. So we know maybe he's not the best.
Not the best. He did resign. But
oh, after that?
After the crash, speed, high-speed chase. It could be that the police logs are incorrect about him being on duty and responding, or that Karen McNamara is just incorrect. I'm not saying she's, like, lying on purpose, but mistakes happen. But a lot of theories kind of lean, or like, okay, or did Jeff Williams get to the scene first before the other officer arrived and something happened?
He's like, I can give you a ride, you know, or something. Yeah,
it's a theory.
I forgot about this, Kylie, so thank you for bringing that up. He was older too, from what I remember, and there was that report of someone that was, could have been her with an older gentleman when mouthing the help me thing.
Yes.
I totally forgot about this part. Yeah, this is a good theory. I'm not going to lie. There's a lot of sketchy stuff that was with this as well. But because nothing was done with it during the time, there's no evidence.
No.
You know, so that's another thing of, like, we'll never. We all knew this case, but, like, this is one of those cases that basically haunts you forever because there's a very good chance we aren't going to get answers.
Yeah, we've said that before, and then we do get some. Like, Long Island serial killer, never would have thought.
Yeah.
True that.
Yeah. You know, one day they're going to dig up that cement thing in the backyard and find her bones, you know, or something like that.
Gosh, if I was the homeowner, I would be saving all my money to do that myself.
100%.
100%.
Yeah. I'd be out there every day with, like, a chisel.
Okay, so I lied. I have one more theory.
Stop it.
What if I told you that 5 weeks after Maura disappeared, another young woman went missing under similar circumstances 90 miles north in Vermont?
There's no way that this just happens to be a serial killer passing at the right time. Isn't that always how they happen?
Perfect scenarios. This is the story of Brianna Maitland. And for time's sake, I'll just give you a little short summary. But if you want a deeper dive, I recommend checking out the podcast called The Vanished. They did a great episode on it. So on March 19th, 2004, 17-year-old Brianna spent the morning taking her GED exam and afterwards met her mom for lunch to celebrate. After lunch, Brianna's mom, Kelly, noted she was a little agitated, but she didn't want to pry. Later that night, Brianna clocked in for work at the Black Lantern Inn. She clocked out around 11:20 p.m., and according to co-workers, she left in her vehicle alone. Early the next day, officers were dispatched to an abandoned vehicle that was kind of backed up into a barn in Richford, Vermont, about a mile from Brianna's job. The officer that responded figured the car had been abandoned by a drunk driver and had it towed. Sound familiar? It took several days for people to realize Brianna was missing. Her roommate was out of town that weekend, and when she returned, she just thought Brianna was staying with other friends. Brianna's mom was the one to report her as missing on March 23rd after not being able to get into contact with her. When she reported Brianna's missing, police are like, oh, is this her car that we found a few days ago? That they knew it was hers.
Tee-hee.
So, like in worst case, police knew it was Brianna's car. Again, license plate. Brianna's paychecks with her names on them were in the passenger seat, like clearly can see from the window. And also, like Morris' case, police thought Brianna was either a runaway, despite her debit card, classes, contact, and medicine being left in the car. They did eventually change their tune and said foul play was probable, and the FBI was brought in, who did a bunch of analysis on the car and the scene and determined that the car crash was staged.
Oh.
Interesting.
Right there, I believe that. You know, like I'm not, it would take a lot for me to not believe something with the FBI. Suspicious, yes. Though. It'd have to be suspicious.
Same as in Morris' case, car, rural area, snow, red barn, just like Morris' case. But the car was kind of like backed into it. And there was like a piece of plywood like placed on top of Brianna's car. It wasn't a very good job of staging it, but
yeah.
So searches ensued, but nothing was found. There were a lot of tips, but one of the big ones was that Brianna was being held hostage in the house of drug dealers named Ramon Ryans and Nathaniel Jackson. Allegedly, according to police, Brianna had bought drugs from them in the past. So the house was raided, but there was no sign of Brianna. Police also investigated the possibility that Israel Keys might have been involved, but he was quickly ruled out by the FBI. So I know, I'm really glad I covered his case because he comes up about once a month. In March of 2016, police announced they found new DNA in Brianna's car, and then in March of 2022, announced they had a match. Person has not been publicly identified, but investigators say the person has been very cooperative. So I don't know if that means they're a suspect or someone who's ridden in Brianna's car. Like, could be anybody. So now we have the proximity, obviously, with Mara and Brianna raising some eyebrows. Their cars were 90 miles apart. They're similar age. Circumstances are the same. Mara's car accident appears to truly be an accident, and Brianna's is staged. Investigators on both cases and the FBI have said they do not believe the cases are connected. It's just a weird coincidence. But the cases are often talked about together online and in other true crime content because what are the odds?
Go hers being the second one and they saying that one was staged is just doesn't, I don't like that doesn't really have a big effect on me. Like my thinking for that, you know, if they were connected because it, the person just saying hypothetically, the person would have just been like, oh, it worked in the first case. Why don't I do this in the second?
Exactly. As of today, Brianna's disappearance is still unsolved, and the FBI has offered a reward of up to $40,000 for information leading to her recovery. Tips can be submitted online at tips.fbi.gov by calling the FBI tip line at 1-800-225-5324 or the Vermont State Police tip line at 1-844-848-8477. In January of 2022, the FBI issued a national alert for Maura Murray's case, opening the ability for multiple law enforcement agencies across the country to share information. Later in the same year, New Hampshire police searched land nearby in Landoff and Easton. And the reason why and anything found in those areas have not been made public. The case of Maura Murray's disappearance is now being handled by the Cold Case Unit, but is still very much open and needing more information. The Murray family is also heavily involved in the case, getting the word out, hoping to find answers. Like I mentioned, Maura's sister Julie runs a podcast called Media Pressure about the case. I highly recommend it. It's 10 episodes. She talks to like other family members and friends, kind of disputes information that the police have given, provides more context.
What do they think? The family?
They kind of tend to think that she did walk off from the crash site and someone snatched her. But
honestly, if someone snatched her, that would make me lean more towards not the police officer.
Yeah.
You know, because that would have been like, I think if the police officer situation happened, it would have been like he rolled up to the scene and offered to help.
And with no history of like things of that nature, I feel like that's a very random thing for.
Yeah, but he was a dick. That happened. So we knew that.
Yeah.
But just because you're a dick doesn't mean you're going to.
Yeah.
Feel and kill someone.
But it is weird. If he's not on duty, he hears the call. He knows someone's going to respond to it. Like, he has such a short amount of time.
Yeah. He had to have just happened to be in the area.
And only one other person saw his car.
Yeah.
So Maura's case is known as the first crime mystery of the social media age, with her disappearance only happening 5 days after Facebook launched. This didn't stop her disappearance from being the hot topic on online forums and blogs. Early in the days of Maura's crash, the website mauramissing.org was launched, and it is still being actively updated to this day. There's blog entries and press releases and yada yada. So if you want to keep up with the investigation, I'd recommend that's the first place you go. Also highlighted on the website are two campaigns that the Murray family are running. The first is Engage with Empathy, a program to offer support for the victims and family members of crime. The program also educates the public and content creators on ethical true crime content. The second campaign is called the Blue Ribbon Campaign. So shortly after Maura's disappearance, they placed a blue ribbon around the tree that she crashed into. Eventually, the owner of the property where the tree was notified the family that they were going to cut down the tree. So the Murray family offered to buy the tree and lease the land that it was on. But before they even heard back, that family had cut the tree down. Subsequent applications to have the site deemed a historical marker were declined by the New Hampshire Division of Historical Resources, which is something the family has since appealed. And you can find these campaigns on the website, mauramurraymissing.org, to read about them and sign the campaigns. It has now been 21 years since Maura Murray was last seen. While we may not know what happened, we can still figure it out and hopefully bring closure in some sort of capacity. If you have any information regarding the whereabouts of Maura Murray, please contact the New Hampshire Cold Case Unit at 603-223-3648. Tips can also be sent directly to the family at mauramurraymissing.org. And I'll put all this information for so many tips in the episode description below and also on our website. And those were the ongoing stories of the disappearances of Maura Murray and Brianna Malin.
That is truly just a case that's always going to be rent-free in my head. Some of our followers let us know after episodes what they think happened. This is a case I'm excited to see who's going to say what. I don't know which one I lean towards the most. I kind of want to say that she walked off and somebody grabbed her, and by somebody, I mean the older guy. What was his name again? Claude. Because he was sketch. Very. His house is sketch. Him himself is sketch. Everything he said was sketch. And he's dead, so we ain't gonna find out anything. But he's my first. My second, I'm tied between her, like, natural death or the police officer.
Yeah, I think natural walking off and hypothermia is probably the most plausible.
Yeah.
Just on its own. But I'm like, they've been searching for 21 years.
You would have found something, especially the dogs and everything. Yeah.
Like, she couldn't have gone that far on foot in the snow.
And there would have been a scent, regardless of the snow.
Yeah. Can I jump into overtime?
Overtime.
Cam and I were talking about this last night, that I read something yesterday, in 2025 alone, there have been 48 plane crashes. Like, yeah, what the hell is going on? I mean, I swear to God, I log into social media every day to a new plane crash happening.
Theory is Pete Buttigieg, the former Secretary of Transportation, was like manually holding all these planes up. Mm-hmm. And as soon as he's gone, they just all crash.
Yeah. You know what Cam said? Wasn't there, was a whistleblower early last year. About the airline industry and something. And before he could say some stuff that of importance, he took his own life.
As
quotation mark. Yeah.
Every whistleblower does.
Yes. So maybe, like, a theory is maybe a certain part on a few hundred thousand planes or something like that was malfunctioning and they were like, this is cheap, so we're still going to use it, or something like that, you know? But it is weird. It makes me very sad. I'm very happy that that Delta plane that flipped over, everybody survived. That blew my mind.
Scary.
Yeah.
You see, they only offered them $30,000 each.
Did you say only?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that was a good number.
Oh, I would have been like,
oh, if that was me. Mm-mm.
No, because they're going to get $30,000 and then they're going to do a class action. 100%.
No, that's sure a settlement.
That it's contingent on not suing.
Yeah, it's a settlement.
Oh, well, then don't take it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't see that part. I thought it was take it and then you can sue.
No, that's like take it and you can't sue.
I just can't. Also,
oh, I'm getting a milli no matter what, you know, like at okay. the least.
A baby or dollars?
Dollars.
It has freaked me out. Delta's had a few crashes this year. Mom's a Delta flight attendant. And then those medical planes that have been crashing with the children inside has really hurt my heart. That there's been like three already.
Luke's trying to convince me because it's making me so nervous that there's so many plane crashes. And if you don't know, he's a pilot trying to be a private pilot right now, but or a commercial pilot. But he's trying to convince me that it's just more media coverage. Like, it's not more plane crashes. We're actually getting better with plane crashes. There's just more media coverage. And I'm like, I don't know if that's true.
That's not true, Lucas.
No, the one in Washington was like the first fatal commercial plane crash in like 100 years or something.
Yeah.
And that one was nuts and very sad. They're all very sad, but that one really hurt my heartstrings. That one, did we even talk about that? The helicopter that hit the plane in D.C., were three amazing and well-deserved in their positions to be on that helicopter. But that helicopter was training. I don't know if you guys knew this. That helicopter specifically, maybe not that one, but the people, that team were specifically training to be the helicopter that would take government officials away from Washington, D.C. if an emergency ever happened.
Wow.
Conspiracy. I don't want to get shot down. But
yeah. It is, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And okay. The girl who was on the helicopter was from North Carolina. Obviously, as it should, it makes everybody nervous about flying because your chances of being in a plane crash were not that high. But in 2025, pretty high so far.
If you were on the Delta flight that flipped over, what's the minimum settlement you would take, and then what would be the first thing you buy?
I'm not gonna lie, I totally would not even think number wise. I'd be like, what is everybody else doing? Like, I wouldn't.
I think the lowest that I would go would be like 5 million. I think there's been people that have gotten a lot more for a lot less traumatic injury.
That's true. And I think airline companies, I'm not calling out Delta, sorry Yolanta, but any of them, they have billions and billions.
Billions of billions of dollars. And think about all the little things, all the little lawsuits that happen every day, and they get way more than that. $5 million would be my min.
That's true. There's car accidents that are in the 100 mils.
Yeah.
We can get five for a plane.
Yep. Traumatic injury, I probably would never fly again. You literally think you're dying. No.
I think five's fair. And with that, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Over My Dad Pod. If you want, like, subscribe, follow, leave us a review. We're going to be announcing something fun over on Instagram coming shortly, so make sure you're following for that. And we'll see you next week with another case. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.